I would like to welcome Dr. Julia Tresida, and she's from the Australian Institute of Criminology. Julia has 20 years' experience working in the fields of youth justice, mental health and alcohol and other drugs. Her role at the Institute of Criminology includes working in partnership with the National Cannabis Prevention and Information Centre. The AIC work for this consortium is focusing on translating the research about cannabis and related criminal justice interventions into plain English. So it provides information for the criminal justice sector about cannabis-related issues. So there's a lot of, obviously when we're talking about early diversion programs, there's a lot of connection here with minor drug offences, and to be sort of doing that diversion rather than going to the locking up and throwing away the key sort of approach. So Julia has a wealth of experience. In fact, we were talking before, and there's even more in that wonderful brain of hers that Coalition will certainly exploit in the future. Thank you for letting us know. And as there's a lot of work to be done. I'd also like, before we hand over to Julia, just to acknowledge that this seminar has been organised in partnership with the Corrections Coalition. At the end, I'm going to give you information about the next seminar that will be run in this area, because obviously there's a number of seminars that are running because of the opening of the Alexander McConaughey Centre. So I will make sure, Bill, that I get that information out. But this is the second in a series, and I think some of you may have read the media or even have attended the last one that also attracted a lot of attention and interest. So we're very, very pleased to be putting the seminar on today in partnership, and I'll hand over to Julia. Thank you.
Hello and welcome, everybody. I recognise quite a few faces in the audience. It's interesting when you work at a federal level in the ACT, because when you come to speak in the ACT, you realise that you might not know as much about your own jurisdiction as you would like. So this has been a great opportunity for me to focus in on the ACT in giving this talk today. And this builds on work that I've been doing for the National Cannabis Prevention and Information Centre. That's a new consortium that the federal government funded, and its nickname is NICPIC, and it's based at NDARC in New South Wales, and the AIC is one of the consortium members for that new centre. And I hear recently that NICPIC has been down here in the ACT and has delivered youth training to people about good cannabis treatment interventions on the ground. So if anyone went along to that training, they'll have a better idea about the National Cannabis Prevention and Information Centre. And if you want to find out more about that, you can look on the website at University of New South Wales, just look up the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre. And our work at the AIC encompasses drugs as well. And if you'd like to read any of the reports that part of my talk is based on, please go to our website, because we've written and published a lot about drug diversion. And we've got some new reports coming out very soon as well. So today I'm going to just go over what we know in general about diversion, what we know about cannabis use, and I'm using cannabis police diversion around Australia as a kind of way into this topic, and at the end I'm going to suggest some future research topics. First of all, diversion as principle. Diversion programs give police and at different levels courts options, and if we divert more young people, particularly at the early end of the criminal justice system, we may hopefully prevent further contact with the system. And we know that once young people have had contact with the system a few times, that they're more likely, if they've offended at an early point in their life, to keep offending and to offend often into early adulthood. So if we can avoid contact with the justice system at a young age for young people, that could have good outcomes for future their future life and their future chances of not being recidivists. It also helps young people avoid stigma, and if you put young people together who are all offenders, you can actually increase their offending, because we know that negative peer influence is one factor in predicting ongoing offending. So we want to connect young people with pro-social friends and adults, rather than bringing them together, say, in the new youth detention centre, where they might only learn more about committing crime. So avoiding stigma, lessening that negative peer influence, and also, slightly more controversially, it does provide opportunities for some sort of treatment or some sort of intervention earlier in their life, particularly for young offenders. And we did have a period from the late 70s onwards where we separated welfare acts from youth justice principles and we made them into separate acts. And that's been in place now in some jurisdictions since the early 80s. And more and more people are beginning to review those acts. And we sort of moved away from treatment in a way, and we moved away from looking after welfare needs as we moved into youth justice acts that dealt with justice separately for youth. And I think now there's a little bit of questioning, did we move a little bit too far away from some of those welfare principles for a while there? And there's certainly a lot written at the moment about best practice in terms of what programs and treatment opportunities you might put in place for people younger, earlier in life before they become recidivist adult offenders. Also, diversion can be good, but it can also have the potential for net widening if the consequence of being diverted is something that you have to do and then you don't do it, and that puts you back into the criminal justice system. And perhaps whatever you did in the first place could have just been an informal caution. And so there is the potential for net widening if people can't kind of do whatever that was required for the diversion to be in place. There's different examples of diversion. So at the really informal level, police can just use their discretion on the ground and choose not to take any further action but give people a warning. In some states and territories, we've got formal cautioning systems in place, and sometimes there's limits to how many cautions you can get. We've got family group conferencing in some jurisdictions, and restorative justice conferencing is actually in the Crimes Act here for juveniles. And they can happen at all different points of the system. I think it's really important to look at the context when you're talking about cannabis, and that context is really about how our community views cannabis. And if you look back at the 2004 National Drug Strategy Household Survey, it's useful to note that about 27% of the adult population actually believe use of cannabis should be legal. Another 28% believe that it should attract a criminal justice penalty and even a record. And 44% said they thought a caution or warning was sufficient. You can read the other ones. 18% supported fines, but only 8% of people supported a correctional response. So a lot of the legislation in different states and territories, I think probably the way cannabis is treated differently from other illicit drugs, reflects very much those differing community attitudes. What do we know about cannabis prevalence? Well, we know that around, I think it's 34% of people who are surveyed over the age of 14 in the large National Drug Strategy Household Survey say that they've used cannabis at least once in their lifetime. And in the last survey, there was 1.8 million people who used cannabis in the last year at some point. Now, this graph actually shows you what people reported in that survey about their use in the last month and in the last week. So as you can see from that survey, 20 to 29-year-olds are the most likely to be regular cannabis users. But actually, if you go to daily users, they're more likely to be in the 30 to 39 age group. And once you get to 40-plus, a lot of people have stopped using cannabis or perhaps never did use cannabis, because if you think about the different cohorts that go through the system, cannabis certainly wasn't probably a very prevalent drug in Australia before the 1960s perhaps, but I don't actually have the historical data to show you that for sure. But as you get into that older section of the age cohort, you find that people are much less likely to have used cannabis, but they're quite likely to have used cannabis if they're under 30. Now, at the AIC, we collect data around Australia at 9 different sites, and that's data about people who've been detained by police and their drug use. And we actually do urinalysis for people who agree to be part of that study. And as you can see, compared to the general population, people who are detained by police do seem more likely to have used cannabis recently than the general population. So I think that's because there's a kind of tends to be a constellation of risk factors around offenders. I don't think that there's any data that would show that cannabis use in itself causes other crime other than cannabis use is illegal everywhere in Australia, so it is a criminal act in itself. But yes, there's certain populations, subpopulations in the general population who are more likely to have used cannabis recently, and police detainees are one of those groups. Now, on this graph, that bar that shows you under 18, that's only a very small sample. That's only 100 young people, and they're mostly from the New South Wales and I think some from the Northern Territory sample. So that's just indicative. The other bars represent a much larger sample, though there could be a little bit of repeated data amongst the group. The other thing that I guess has been a lot more written about more recently is about cannabis dependence. That was always a very controversial topic in the past, whether or not people could become dependent on cannabis. With the kind of brain research that's been done, we've found there are cannabinoid receptors in the brain. So there's a biological basis for some sort of cannabis dependence. However, cannabis dependence is much less likely than dependence on tobacco or other illicit drugs or alcohol. So while you can become dependent on cannabis, it's much less likely than for other drugs. Also, in a way, it's treatment samples that have led us to believe that there's cannabis dependence, and they're sort of slightly different from population. So it could still be queried by some people, I'm sure. There was an article in a book that was published in 2006 about cannabis dependence, and my last dot point on this slide, its main reference is to that article, and the estimation that one in six regular users in Australia may become dependent on cannabis was actually a statistic that came out of a cohort study in Victoria that was done by people at the Centre for Adolescent Health. And actually, that estimate is much higher than some other countries' estimates about dependence on cannabis. And it was in a particular birth cohort, and it was amongst a younger population. So I just thought that was an interesting slide just to update with people on the international literature around cannabis dependence. So anyway, I guess partly because cannabis use is illegal everywhere in Australia and is more prevalent amongst those engaged in antisocial and criminal behaviour, through our drug strategy, there has been a lot more funding given over the past, I'm not sure how many years, I'm sure somebody could tell me exactly how many, since about 1997 or 98, I think, there's been more money made available for diversion programs in regards to illicit drug use. So today I'm really concentrating on the police level of programs. I'm not really trying to go into court, pre-court or court order level diversion for drugs, because around Australia there's really, really a huge amount of difference in how programs are implemented, and it's very hard to piece it all together. It's like having a broken Roman mosaic on the floor and trying to piece it all together, because there's several reports now that try to piece together the picture across Australia for both drug and police level diversion programs, but it's a very complex picture, so I'm not going to try to cover all the ground. Recently the Drug Modelling Policy Project, which is also based at the University of New South Wales, but there's also people here at the ANU who are part of that program, they put together some information on all the different programs, and I've got permission from them just to use that breakdown in percentage today about police diversion programs around Australia. They've reckoned that about 29% of them are specifically about cannabis, that just for other illicit drugs, about 25% of them are about cannabis. And when they say for drug or drug-related offenders, 46%, I presume that means that that could be cannabis or illicit drugs, and that drug-related offenders means having paraphernalia or plants as well, because we don't have any police diversion that actually allows police to divert offenders who may have offended because of their drug use. It needs to be a drug-related offence. But, you know, I'm also acknowledging on that slide that there are court diversion and correctional programs. So I'd just like to say something about the juvenile high-risk group. And really, if we're thinking about youth, this goes from 18 up to about 25, and as we saw on that slide before, you're much more likely to be a regular cannabis user in your 20s. But when you look at profiles of treatment samples, and recently a treatment organisation that's based in New South Wales and has also got a facility here in the ACT, the Ted Noffs Foundation, they looked at some of their client data and they did an analysis about people who said that cannabis was their main drug of choice, who were in drug treatment. And in the treatment sample that we put together for all of Australian treatment, for young people, 50% of people coming to treatment say that cannabis is their primary drug of concern. And that's young people identifying that themselves. So the Ted Noffs Foundation sees very complex clients. They tend to be referred from, a lot of them from New South Wales justice system. And they found in their analysis that of the people who identified cannabis as their primary drug of concern, 3 out of 4 of those clients had committed property offences with 1.7 mean arrests in the past 3 months. Now, people who identified other illicit drugs as their primary drug of concern had actually committed more offences and a larger proportion of them had committed offences, but that's still a very high proportion. So basically, once you start looking at young people who've initiated cannabis use when they're 12 or 14, you're thinking of very complex young people who are going to have many problems, and their cannabis use is probably just one of those issues. So I think it's really good to keep that in mind, and to keep in mind that if we're diverting young offenders early in their offending careers, we possibly should be assessing them for more than just their cannabis use issues. We should be assessing them for their family stability, other mental health issues, whether or not they're connected to their school or community in any pro-social way. So while this is focused on cannabis, I just want you to keep in mind that when we're talking about helping the younger offenders, we're talking about addressing their other problems too, I think, if we want to do a good job. So this is an overview about police cannabis diversion schemes in Australia. And this slide was first used by Simon Lenton, who works at Andrea in Perth. And I've just adapted it for my purpose. He didn't have indicated where juveniles were or weren't in the legislation or policy, but I've added that. So prohibition with civil penalties exists here in the ACT, obviously, and in South Australia, the Northern Territory and Western Australia. That doesn't mean that you don't also have other diversion under the illicit drug diversion strategy money, but you've got civil penalties for minor cannabis offenders as a possibility in those 4 states and territories. And in the other jurisdictions, they've got prohibition with cautioning programs in place, but no fines. And incidentally, at the moment, the ACT is the only jurisdiction that treats juveniles and adults in more or less the same way and allows fines to be given to people under 18. So that's the difference. Apparently Western Australia is considering extending their new program to juveniles, but I'm not sure whether that's actually going to happen. I've just been told it's been considered. Recently the AIC have done some work with the diversion programs that are funded under the illicit drug diversion strategy. And while the report should be released in the not too distant future, I think, at the moment, we were able to share this bit of demographic data about that work. So this focused on just programs that were funded under the illicit drug diversion strategy. And I've been able to report here what percentage of those samples were male, a mean age, and the age range of people being diverted under those programs. So actually this doesn't include data on your civil penalties here in the ACT. As well as it doesn't include data on the South Australia or Northern Territory civil penalty scheme, but it does include WAs. So even though many of these jurisdictions actually don't allow juveniles to be diverted under these schemes, you'll see from the age range that for police on the ground, they often use the adult schemes with younger people. And certainly when I've tried to look at each jurisdiction and the complexity of all the different programs available to police, you could understand how when you're operating on the ground, it may be difficult to differentiate between all the criteria for all of the programs all of the time, which is why we think there's such a big age range, even for the jurisdictions that supposedly don't caution adolescents. And sometimes some of the programs are complex because under one part of it they will divert juveniles, like the illicit drug part but not the cannabis part, so it's a little bit complex. I think here you can see that the ACT under the cannabis diversion program, or not cannabis, the drug diversion program here has included people from 13 to 53. Now, people in the room are going to know more about this than myself. So I've done a summary here of what I know about ACT police diversion for cannabis. So there's the simple cannabis offence notice scheme. And there's also the ACT policing early intervention and diversion program. So one attracts a fine and one is getting assessment and voluntary treatment components. Offenders have to admit offences to be given either of these options, and they can also be arrested and charged for cannabis possession or in the case of growing up to 2 plants. But in the legislation it says, I think, that the leaves on those 2 plants can't weigh more than, I think it's 100 grand. And no hydroponic plants can be included anymore, and it is all discretionary. So the cannabis brochure that the ACT hands out clearly says there's 3 things that may happen to you if you get caught, and one of them is being arrested and charged, and these are the other 2 options. People with concurrent violent offences can't be included in the ACT policing early intervention and diversion program. And also, you can only get 2 diversions. So it seems that juvenile cautioning here is an informal cautioning scheme. There's nothing in the legislation that kind of indicates that diversion should be a principle, or that there's no formal diversion at the police stage that's in the legislation at the moment. I searched the bill, but then I found another description that reassured me that said, yes, the ACT and Victoria are unlike every other state and territory in this respect, that there isn't any legislative base for police diversion of juveniles, but I'm sure juvenile cautioning and informal cautioning probably occurs, but we wouldn't have any data about that. So that is an interesting sort of point. And the other thing that's interesting about Victoria that could be worth the ACT looking at is that in Victoria, they actually, anybody up to the age of 20 who's sentenced in an adult court can actually be sentenced to spend their time in the juvenile facilities in Victoria, in recognition that people up to 20 are still really young people and maybe more vulnerable. And also within the Victorian prison system, there's actually 2 streams, and there's special units in lots of the adult jails for people under 25. So that could be another innovative practice that the ACT might want to consider for the new facility. And, you know, for people in magistrates and judges in the adult court to be able to see that somebody is developmentally immature if they're 19 or 20, I think it's a really good innovative practice that those people can be protected in some ways by being put into the juvenile facility. So they're not sentenced in the juvenile court, but there's that ability for them to serve their time with younger people, because we know the developmental age spectrum includes young people up to 20 who really aren't as developmentally mature as some of their peers. And some of these people may still be offending in a way that brings attention to themselves. But I think it's quite protective that Victoria has that policy, and it might be something worth considering here. So you do have in the Crimes Act the Restorative Justice Conference for Juveniles. And I don't know how much that's used here or whether it's ever used in relation to drug offences. But I think it's more at the court level. Now, I made this graph a few days ago. ACT and other states and territories supply cannabis-related information to the Australian Crime Commission, who produces this as an illicit drug report each year. And I thought this was quite interesting. I didn't go back any further, and if you go back any further, the use of the simple cannabis offence notice has dropped even more steeply before this, in the 5 years before this. But it's interesting to note that the simple cannabis offences notices have been used less, and that arrests for cannabis have gone up in the ACT. Now, there's some data missing off this slide, and somebody here might be able to fill us in on what that slope would look like. But we don't have data here about who's being diverted under the EDI program. We don't have that data. So the reason that the fines might have gone down is that some of those people who might have got fines before might be now diverted for education and treatment, and that's probably the case. So there could be a third line in this slide. And the fact that the arrests seem to have gone up, that could be because people have been growing hydroponic plants and that's no longer included as a reason to get a fine. I mean, it could be any number of things. So I'm sure people here might be better able to interpret that information, but I thought it was an interesting slide. Now, I thought this hasn't been... this is a little bit of an unfair comparison because each of these jurisdictions has a different population, and Northern Territory and ACT have a relatively small population, whereas South Australia's is probably a bit larger. And I haven't adjusted this slide for rates per 100,000, which you often do when you compare jurisdictions. But it's interesting that South Australia's use of fines for cannabis has also dropped. And they obviously use them a lot more, because they've got thousands. And the little blue line is where WA started. And they haven't been doing it for as long, so they're about to review their legislation around their fine system. And I think that you're no longer going to be allowed to grow any plants there and still be fined. I think that's another change they're looking at that I've been told about by WA, but we'll have to wait to see what those changes actually are when they come through. If anyone's got any questions at any point, don't feel bad if you interrupt. Now, I thought that rather than focus any more on the ACT, because like with any jurisdiction, the further down you dig, the more you know you don't know, because it's in policy and their models about how the diversion tiers are used and they change a lot and you could get it wrong basically. So I thought it might be interesting for people here just to have a quick look at what other jurisdictions do. So the Queensland Police Drug Diversion Program is mandatory for police to use, which I think South Australia has one mandatory EDI program, but it's kind of unusual. Most of them are discretionary. If you get a caution, then it's mandatory referral, and you can't have previously been offered drug diversion. There's lots of criteria about whether or not you can be cautioned there. And some of those criteria tend to mean that certain groups of people don't get cautioned. And I think in the near future some work may come out around use of cautions and diversionary programs with Indigenous groups. And sometimes it's difficult for Indigenous people to meet criteria in some of the states and territories because of prior violent offences or prior offending. So there's often discussion about how different programs are set up and how their criteria may mean some groups are less likely to get diverted. Now, in Queensland, there has been research done and published, and it's quite hard to find good evaluation data that's public about any of these programs. So there's two things that I've highlighted here, and I really recommend people to read the different evaluations that are available. And if you have a look on the AIC website, you'll find a monograph by Joy Wunderstutz, which has summarised all the evaluation evidence for all the layers of the programs and is an excellent report. Basically, quite often when we evaluate the drug diversion programs, very few evaluations look at drug use. They mostly all focus on recidivism, which is their purpose, to try to reduce recidivism. And so very often they don't collect very much data around whether, when people got diverted to educational treatment, whether their drug use actually changed is often not recorded in the evaluations. I certainly think it'd be a cost-effective, good thing to do to start including in any evaluations data around drug use over time for people who are diverted to education or treatment. But recently some people in Queensland, some academics, went and took a sample of people, about 600, who attended one treatment centre in Brisbane who'd been cautioned under the Queensland scheme. And they asked people a whole lot of questions, and they used the severity dependence scale, and they found that 60% of those 600 and something people actually measured on that scale as being dependent on cannabis. So they may have gained something from being referred for assessment, because they might have just got a bit more insight into how their use differed from the population sort of level use. And that can sometimes be all people need to think about changing their drug use. Just simply knowing how they might differ from the general population curve in relation to use. Because they might only have friends who all use exactly the same amount as themselves. They might not have very much insight into that use. So brief interventions are really quite effective in this area. And so there could be some positive benefits from people getting assessment. Now, when Jim Hales evaluated this program, and it was a little while ago now, he looked at drug use and amongst a sample of people who'd been cautioned, and 95% when he first asked them had been using cannabis regularly when they were cautioned, and 74% reported regular use 6 months on. It was self-report data and may have some biases in it. You might be reluctant to admit you're still using cannabis regularly if you can only be cautioned once. But equally, they might not have been using as regularly. They might have assessed their use and be using less. In New South Wales, juveniles aren't included in the cannabis cautioning scheme, and young offenders are cautioned by police under the Young Offenders Act. And there's not publicly available data about how many are cautioned for cannabis. There's also family group conferences there, and some of them possibly also occur because of cannabis, minor cannabis charges. The cautioning scheme in New South Wales for adults is discretionary, and minor possessions only up to 15 grams dried cannabis, and there's two cautions and two layers to the scheme. And I don't know how much has been published about evaluations or about whether or not people actually ring up the ADIS service to kind of expiate their caution. In Victoria, there's an adult cannabis cautioning program, and Victorian police have a large cautioning program for juveniles. And there's also another drug diversion program that includes people aged 10 and over. I think juveniles suddenly sometimes do get cautioned under the adult scheme. So. South Australia's got expiation notices, and it's also got the South Australia Police Drug Diversion Initiative. Juveniles aren't supposed to be given a cannabis expiation notice. But it's a mandatory kind of intervention to assessment for juveniles under their Police Drug Diversion Initiative. So for juveniles, it includes cannabis, and for illicit drugs, it's adults and juveniles there. So they do it slightly differently to the ACT, who's more kind of the way you treat juveniles is more the same. Tasmania Police have a three-level scheme. The first two levels are for cannabis. The third level is for illicit drug use. And they've got a Youth Justice Act, and I think that must include some diversion for young people for minor offending. Northern Territory's got an infringement notice scheme, and they call it the pre-court diversion program, but I think it's done by police. And basically, that includes juveniles and adults, and the age range of the IDI-funded program for Northern Territory is quite low. It's one of the lower ones. In WA, they've been trialling their cannabis infringement notices, and there was a Young People's Opportunity program, which was slightly different, but that kind of allowed young people to be diverted in another level of their system, and they've got a Young Offenders Act that I think includes diversion. There has been quite a lot of research in WA, and I'd really recommend people have a look at their large report. A large technical report came out in November. It has a lot of information about other jurisdictions as well as Western Australia. It's a real tome. It's very thick. It will take you a long time to get through, but it's got really useful information in there if you're interested. Simon Linton over in Perth at the National Drug Research Institute, he has done opinion sort of surveys around the introduction of the legislation, And interestingly, he found in the earlier survey that 79% of the people they surveyed supported the introduction of the fine system, and that had dropped actually when they redid it in 2007 to only 66% of people saying they supported it. But as he points out, it's still a majority of people who support it, and the samples might have just differed in who was captured. I think about 800 people were in each sample. It wasn't too small. And over that time, the other thing to note is that cannabis use around Australia has actually dropped. The National Drug Strategy Household Surveys and the school surveys show a drop in cannabis use. I think it peaked in about 1998 surveys, and it's come down in every survey since. And the Drug Strategy Household Surveys due for release this year, the last year's survey. So soon we'll have the new data because all the data I've been using is from 2004. So I sort of want to end the talk there because I think it would be really useful to hear what the audience thinks about the differences between ACT and other jurisdictions, how people here think the system works here, whether people have got any other comments. But I just wanted to say, for anyone here who actually works with young people, the National Children's and Youth Law Centre in Sydney provides a really, really useful service for young people under 18. This website tells young people for each jurisdiction how the law in that jurisdiction relates to them. And it's all written in plain English, and it's really easy to use. You can click on your state, you can find out all kinds of things about how the legislation applies to you as a young person. And it's pretty complicated for adults to work it out, so it's very good that the National Children's and Youth Law Centre provides that service, so just let people know about that. And finally, I guess before we break into discussion, I think that we don't know very much about diversion in general, particularly how many young people might be diverted in different jurisdictions under the Youth Justice Act for cannabis offences. We don't know much about rates of diversion, how they might differ in urban and rural settings. We know there's some discrepancy about how diversion works for Indigenous and non-Indigenous groups, but I don't really think we know very much about necessarily how that operates on the ground and how it looks in different jurisdictions and why, and whether that's because some people don't want to admit offences, which you often have to do to be diverted, whether that's because police don't always apply the same principles to similar offenders, because police in small communities particularly tend to know the people they come in touch with day to day. And I mean, there's lots of complicated factors, and then there's community attitudes, and I don't think anyone's done a study that's really investigated all the possible influences to investigate who gets diverted, when, why, whatever. And it could be quite complicated research. We've got a small amount of research on police attitudes to schemes. I know in the evaluation of the Queensland cautioning system, which does include juveniles, that I think 46% of police who were asked in the evaluation felt like it disempowered them with young people to give a caution. They felt less respected by young people for being able to do that. So there's obviously varying attitudes amongst police to the schemes, but I have anecdotally sort of heard that in some big jurisdictions that while the police may be divided 50-50 on whether they think it's a good idea or not, most of them do actually use the diversion schemes. There's a whole lot of issues about use of police discretion, and there's more and more known now about the effectiveness of interventions for cannabis, but they might be different from other drug treatment interventions. And it seems like motivational interviewing and brief interventions are probably a good way to go with cannabis. And at the moment, the National Cannabis Prevention Information Centre is working towards a set of national treatment guidelines for cannabis, because I think often drug treatment services have focused very much on injecting illicit drug use for good reason, because bloodborne virus sort of issues and a whole lot of risk issues around injecting. But perhaps we know less and we've done less about cannabis. But there's been an increase in the people going to drug and alcohol treatment services for cannabis-related issues, saying cannabis is their primary drug of concern. And they make up a larger proportion of people in the treatment sector, particularly for the brief intervention end, than do people going for other illicit drugs. So alcohol is still outweighs them all in terms of people presenting for treatment. But if we could know more, we should know more, and it's good that more is being invested in finding out. So thank you.